Whenever you're ready.
So it's 1992, and I wanted to be in the Peace Corps since I was 15. When John Kennedy said, "Ask not what you can do for your country." Oh, and I was a freshman in college when he was killed. So there's a lot of killing surrounding my early years of famous people and things. So at he said, "Ask not what your country can do for you. Ask what you can do for your country." And then, literally about 2 to 3 months later, they announced the Peace Corps. And I'm 15, right? And I think, oh, what a wonderful idea. Oh, I want to do that. So now I'm almost 50. I'm about 47, I guess, 48. And I go, I want to join the Peace Corps. Bruce, I want to join the Peace Corps. And just like that, he comes back. He didn't take 5 seconds. And he came back and said, "Well, if it's good for you, it'll be good for both of us." And I burst into tears. I was not expecting that. I expected to get an argument. How could you do that? You're running a business, you're da da da, mid-career, you know, whatever. I said, "No, if it's good for you, it'll be good for both of us." And I literally did, I burst into tears. It was the most gracious thing I think I'd ever heard in my life at that point. My family thought I was insane. Older sister thought she'd bring me back in a straitjacket. But other than that, you know, there was a lot of support. So I joined the Peace Corps and volunteered. I didn't know there were 20,000 people applying the year I applied, so I would never have applied. I wouldn't have thought I'd get in. But that particular year, they had been asked, because countries have to ask for stuff. We don't march out and say, "We're sending you 10 something or others." They have to ask. So that particular year, a couple of former Soviet countries, so it's 92, and the fall of the wall was 89. And so things are beginning to regel and whatnot, and a few of the former USSR countries had asked for some volunteers. Slovakia already had school teachers. They asked for English language school teachers. They had forestry people, because they had gorgeous, huge, big forests, which were affected by some of the industrialization and stuff. And they wanted to preserve them. And they had medical, something, nurses, something, I can't remember. But they wanted business people. And the man I eventually got to work with wanted a 65-year-old male insurance person, and he got me. that's as close as they got. But they wanted what they called post-experience people. Our oldest was 73. And our youngest was almost 30. I think he was 29, almost 30. And I was right sort of in the middle. I turned 50 in the Peace Corps. It was tremendous. It was the best thing I ever did for myself up to that point. It was a wonderful, wonderful experience. And transformative, as they say, really, really changed everything for me. It was just magnificent. I got to Slovakia, which I can show you where it is. It's between Hungary on the bottom and Poland and the Czech Republic and Austria on the top. And a much quieter kind of a backwater. And I was posted way out east in the High Tatra Mountains. When I came back we live with a Slovak family for the first 3 months, and you learn language. And we were studying the economics of Central Europe. Oh, yes, well. and I came back and they said, "What?" Because 6 weeks in, they tell you where you're going to go. And I came back to the house at the end of the day, and they said, "Where are you going? Where are you going?" Because they all knew what we're up to. "Where are you going?" And I went, "Poprad? Oh, you are the winner." And I went, "What?" And I'm out in the High Tatra Mountains. It's gorgeous. It's magnificent. A wonderful job. A brilliant man to work with. I really was the winner, only I didn't know. They somehow knew right away. And for them, we were the regional business center, regional business development center. And they were working with small businesses to get them started. They hadn't had any small businesses for 70, 80 years. And nobody knew marketing, inventory control, business plan writing, quality control. I mean, everything had to be covered. So all of, there were 30 of us, half of us in the Czech Republic, half of us in the Slovak Republic. We studied together, but then we separated after that. We all worked in different kinds of, and I was up in the mountains, and people were getting their big houses back. They had been confiscated, as we, you know, borrowed by the government to turn into health centers so that coal miners could come and breathe the fresh mountain air, and other people who had other diseases could have a healthy place to recover and so forth. I learned a lot about some of the good stuff the Soviets did and some of the not so good stuff, but it was remarkable. Well, these people were getting their big old family houses back. I mean, 15 room semi-palaces and things back, and didn't know what to do with them. You know, should we just tear them down and build a little bungalow or something? And so we started a bed and breakfast program and an association, and with this small business development center, and we helped them write business plans for their houses and what needed to be fixed up and how many bathrooms had to be put in and what kind of food to serve for breakfast, and don't only do bed and breakfast, you don't want to open a hotel, it's much more work, and you know, on and on. And they had no idea how to market it, how to set things up and so forth. So I contacted a group called the Innkeepers of America, and they found scholarships for, I think, 10 of them to go to their annual convention, stay there for, I guess, 3 days, and learn, and they had to have good English, so we selected the people who could follow. And we'd already prepped them on various things. And then they spent the second week in a bed and breakfast working with the owners and making beds and making brownies and, you know, cleaning up messes and, you know, all the rest of it, and learning how to build a brochure and advertise on the radio and whatever else their particular inn, you know, their bed and breakfast was doing. Wonderful experience, just wonderful. And I got to come back with them. Well, you're never allowed to come back. When you're in Peace Corps, you're in the Peace Corps. You don't trip back and forth weekends or something. But special papal dispensation or something, and I got to come back and watch this happen. It was just great. I mean, it was just... And the most stunning thing is we got a big limo. Somebody sent a big limo for us. All of us piled in. 10 of them, 2 of us, piled into this giant limo, drive off, and we up Illinois or something, to go drop people off at their various places. And the driver says, is anybody hungry? And the whole place, yeah, we're hungry. Okay, so he pulls off to a truck stop or something, you know, on the freeway. And it's a McDonald's. And so we all pile out. And I hadn't been to McDonald's because I've been living abroad. You know, I didn't know from one end of McDonald's to the other. So I'm standing there staring and trying to read the signs. And one of the women, one of the Slovak women who's going to turn her house into a bed and breakfast, walks straight up and goes, I want a Big Mac and fries and a large Coke. And I went, where did you learn that? She said, in the movies. And I was stunned, I had no idea what to do. So anyway, it was a wonderful experience. Marketing was an unknown quantity, just-in-time planning, accounting, double entry, I mean, all sorts of stuff. And there was a wonderful handicrafts chain in Slovakia where the older craftspeople trained the next generation had been gone for years. And beautiful things, I've got some lovely things from Slovakia. Well, in the mountains, people come to hike in the summers and they ski in the winters. And so we go up there a weekend or something and they're closed in the winter. And so we get a hold of the manager and can we see you and so, and they say, when are you open? Well, Monday to Friday. Well, when do people come to stay in the mountains? Well, pretty much they get off the trains Friday afternoon, and then they'll go back late, you know, because it's an 8-hour trip back to Bratislava, and then go to work on Monday. And you're closed when? Well, we're closed Saturday and Sunday. I mean, that was kind of... And so it took us the whole 2 years to talk them into being open at the weekends and trading off, because they wanted to go to church. They hadn't been able to go to church for years. So they traded off who's going to go to church this week and did a schedule, and so they were open. And we got signs in 3 languages. We are open at the weekend. I have a picture of me standing next to 3 languages, in Polish and Slovak and English. And the other thing was you were only allowed to use a credit card once a day. So if you saw something an hour later or later, you know, in the afternoon and you wanted to buy it on a I'm sorry, sir, you were in this morning. Use your credit card again. So we had to do that kind of stuff. There was a luncheonette fellow opened in the front of his house, and we went to see, you know, at lunchtime, see what the crowd was, which sandwiches were selling, you know, looking, find out. And we go, and there's a sign saying closed. Well, Slovakia is a very family-oriented country, and so we go, oh, something's wrong. So Peter, Peter Litovitz, brilliant man, I watched him speak six languages on one phone call one time. Six languages. Stunningly brilliant man. And he phoned them up the next day and says, everything all right with the family? Oh yeah, we're fine, why? Well, we were there yesterday, lunchtime, and it was closed. And the answer was, we have to eat lunch too. And you just sort of went, we have a lot of work to do. You know, we really have to work really hard. So anyway, it was a magnificent experience. I wouldn't trade it for anything. I'd recommend it to anybody who asks. You know, I just fabulous time.
What was it like working through the language barrier?
I was appalling. After 6 weeks of the, we're all learning, some of them learned it just like this. It was stunning. People just picked it up out of our 30. There was the dumb class. There were about five of us. And we just, and I came bounding in after 5 or 6 weeks, and we had to say what we did at the weekend. And I said a whole Slovak sentence. I said, yesterday, for breakfast, I ate an entire umbrella. I thought the teacher's a wonderful woman. I thought she would faint on the floor. She laughed so hard. She's a young woman. She's 30 or something. And she just tears and weeping and just awful. And I never got much better. Dear Lord, and all the rest of the day, every once in a while, she'd go like this. And yet, I watched one of my colleagues, we went out to negotiate for a rental of an office so she could open one of these business centers out in Košice, I think, in the east. And so they were looking at the rental agreement and the photocopier agreement and something and something. And she kept looking at me and saying, what do you think? Is there? And she's speaking fluent Slovak. And Judith, do you think that's a good idea? And she said, and I went, oh, yeah. I'm sure. Yeah. No, I couldn't help her at all. I could help her with the setup and I could help her with the, you know, let's get it done. But I could not negotiate a lease agreement in Slovak. Anyway, I came back from there and I was hooked on the working abroad stuff. So after that, I took a job first, and they always tell you at the end of the Peace Corps, it's going to be more culture shock than coming here, because you think it's going to be the same when you go back, and it won't be. The first job you take will not be the job you wind up doing. It'll be nice and it'll pay the bills for a while, but it won't be it, which is kind of a scary thing. Thirdly, you'll find some very nice people who weren't ever in the Peace Corps, much to your amazement, because you'll think only decent people, you know, of course they had to have been in the Peace Corps, so there's a lot of adjustment. So anyway, I came back, first job wasn't it, nice, but it wasn't it. And then I just started taking projects overseas. So I worked in Russia for the Peace Corps, training director in Moscow and Vladimir for the next intake. Wonderful. It happened to be in the winter for 6 months, not very bright, but it was terrific. I loved it. And then from there went just projects. 3 months here, 6 months there, you know, a lot of that. Wound up in Cambodia for the League of Women Voters. The League, my grandmother was a member, my mother was a member, I'm a member. And they sent me to Cambodia to produce and the first nonpartisan voter's guide for Cambodia. And I have one. Here we are. And there were 39 political parties. And so this is the descriptor and so forth. And then each party had to be contacted. We asked them the same question. They all had the same questions, and they all had this much space to answer in. And Khmer doesn't have punctuation, so the editing had to be very carefully done so it didn't change their meaning.
So you helped create this?
Yeah, this is what I worked with an NGO there. Each one had their own symbol, had their own head of who was running for parliament, their own platform, and then what their views were on agriculture, the environment, education. I honestly can't remember.
So there are profiles on each of the candidates and just a random
each party,
order?
Each party.
Wow, really
and
cool.
As far as I remember, we did put them in alphabetical order, and there were 39. It took us forever to pull it together before the election. I was there for 8 months, I think. It took us forever to pull it together. But they had to be equal.
Yeah.
The same. This is what the ballot looked like. And it was... Each one had the symbol, so you knew if you were voting for the candlestick party or the palm tree party, or, you know, that's all you had. You really needed to know. And we had an artist on staff, and he did posters for us and all this, because the NGO was primarily involved with HIV education. And they were doing this because they got a grant from the USAID or something and the League to send somebody to work with their staff to produce this. I had a copy in English, I don't know where it is. Because we had to print in English.
Hmm? Is that your first experience dealing with non-partisan voter work? Or
aside from being
voting,
a League member, yeah, before that. But yes, up close and personal, yes.
Cool.
They'd never had one before. Some of these were, you know, three fellas in a coffee shop kind of parties. But some of them were really intense and really, really wanted to have an elected parliament and so forth.
Do you know if they still make these kinds of...
I do not. Papers? I do not. Hun Sen was still in. He's still in. He says he's retiring now. So they didn't get rid of him. They didn't get rid of him for 20 more years. So he's been in. Pol Pot died when I was there. And we had to get it published and printed and out of Phnom Penh overnight. So we sent it in the prophylactic trucks, which went, because there's so much HIV, that went to all the small villages. And what we discovered, which we didn't plan for, is that the teachers got them, so we delivered as many as we could to each village, but a lot of illiteracy. The teachers got them and read them every night in the school. So they'd gather and they'd either read it down in Khmer or they'd read it across. And this is what this party says about education, this is what this party says about it, this is what this party. And they'd read them for like 2 weeks after, just before the election. It was just remarkable. It was just remarkable.
Well, that's cool. So the information that you created was getting spread.
Yeah. That's yeah. Cool. And so they're still working. I have a letter from King Sihanouk saying thank you so much in both English and Khmer. Somewhere. I don't know where.
So you mentioned being a part of the League of Women Voters and your mother and your sister. How long did you start doing that? What kind of things did you do a part of that?
I have a picture of my grandmother, which I can dig out. It's my younger sister put it on a pin, which I wear to all my prep marches. And it's her as a suffragette, white.
Oh, cool.
And so she was a member of the League in the 20s. Next year is the 100th anniversary of the League of Women Voters. 2020 is 100 years. So sometime, we don't know exactly, 24, 26, somewhere in there, my grandmother joined the League because she remembered when women couldn't, she was an adult and married when she couldn't vote.
Mm-hmm.
And then my mother was quite active in the League. And then I was been a member. And then when I came back, I joined here again. It's been a while. But there was a League that sent me over to Cambodia. So, anyway, and that is nonpartisan, and I've discovered since I'm back, because several of these projects that I took with the OSCE, the Organization for Security and Cooperation in Europe, it was all nonpartisan. Well, for instance, in the Peace Corps, you were not allowed to go to any demos. You were not allowed to go hear political lectures or speeches. You are not allowed to do anything that could be misinterpreted as politically active or interested or anything, because a lot of Central Europe thought we were spies. It's a core, isn't it? I mean, honest and true. They expected to show up in blue hats or something. And so we could not do anything that was political. I had to get special permission to meet the president of Slovakia. Because it could have been interpreted as, you know, as a political statement. Oh, the Peace Corps sent him down to what's his name, who's the, you know, this particular party and stuff like that. So it had to be all cleared. The projects were in things like Bosnia-Herzegovina. I was Republika Srpska, Serbia, Armenia. I was the head of mission in Croatia for a whole 2 weeks because it was 1999 changing to 2000. Everybody wanted to go home because it was the change over to 2000, and people's banks and their computers didn't know how to make a 2 at the beginning of things. So they thought planes were going to crash and the world was going to come to an end because nobody's computers knew how to go past 1990-something. So they all wanted to go home. I said, I'm not going home. Why would I fly if I think it's going to fall out of the air? I'm staying here. You're head of mission, dear. So I am an OSCE head of mission for 2 solid weeks in Croatia. Where else? Republika Srpska. We slept with ballot boxes various places. One time in Srpska, I'm pretty sure it was Republika Srpska, I was in a really tough polling station as the observer and the supervisor, because they had to send in supervisors. They'd always voted 90% for whomever the government told them to. So this was like first free and freer election. And it was known for stuffing its ballot box. It was known that this particular polling station up country. And I didn't go to the outdoor toilet for 19 hours. Because I knew as soon as I left, you know, there'd be an extra 1,500 ballots stuffed in and there'd be no way to figure out who they wanted. So they were plying me with wine and sodas. And wouldn't you like, you need water? Have you? No, thank you, I'm fine. And we finally got everything counted, tied up, you know, numbered, all the rest of it. It's loaded in the back of my Pajero. I'm ready to, and excuse me. I got trotting up to the outdoor loo. Oh, thank God. And I came back and I got a hand. I got a round of applause for making it. And they had a legit election that year. Well, that stuff makes me cry because I get so disgusted here with people. We had a 50% turnout and it was a big deal last year in Grapevine or something. 50% of just the registered voters. And I go, do you know how many people died for that? Do you know how many people still can't do that? Do you know how dangerous it was to do in Serbia, Croatia? We couldn't go to Kosovo. Women could not go to Kosovo when I was working in Serbia because they knew they'd be armed and they knew the ballot would be taken and it would be dangerous. Jeez. I had to disarm a man who came into the polling station I was in, and he was the chairman. And my interpreter said, Jonathan, he's got a gun in his pocket. I just hope you noticed that. And I said, oh, really? Okay, come on. And she said, no. I said, yeah, come on. And we had to go over and, excuse me, sir, but we really, remember, see the sign? No weapons at all inside the polling station. Well, I carry money during the week. I said, not today, sir. You are the chief, so must set the standard, you know, or something like that. And he left, he went home, locked it up at home, came back, fine. But that sort of stuff was going on. And here people just can't be bothered. Well, it's a Tuesday, whatever. And I just want to shout at them. We were sitting in another, it was in Bosnia, in a sports hut. And the bunch of us are sitting out front because we didn't have many takers at that point. And this car races up and jumps, the guy jumps out, it's dust all over, and he says, you people get out of here, you people, you have no right to be here, and blah, blah, blah. And I said, excuse me, sir, but the Central Election Commission, the CEP, remember that, they have, this is scheduled, and we are a polling station, and we will be staying here. Well, I think you should, I said, no, sir, we'll be here. So he drives off, comes back in about 25 minutes, roars in, jumps out of the car, and he's armed. No, he was armed the first time. That's it. And I marched him off. And I said, listen, don't you interfere with this. And I'm sick and tired of this. I'm not going to put up with this. And I marched off and put my hand in some pig shit. That's all right. So we were scared. You know, we were all scared. And they're all Bosnians. And they'd just been through a war. So they knew what's possible. He comes roaring back. And he brings big bottles of Coke and a cake and some rolls and stuff. Thank you for being here. It's really wonderful. And we all go, oh, dear God. Thank you. Wasn't that nice of him? It was lovely. And then he drives off. It was like that a lot. So scary. So when people won't vote here, I just want to smack them. I found out in the last couple of elections, I'm really not very good and not really capable of doing partisan elections. I just don't get it. So I just, you know, you gung-ho for somebody and gung-ho and oh, do that. I can register people. I can march. I can work election non-part, you know, I can work elections and make it a fair election. I know that stuff, but the partisan stuff I'm not so good at. I get disheartened and things. So I do nonpartisan stuff. Period. That's it. I'm finished.
How long were you working at polling stations and advocating for these free elections with the Peace Corps?
I left in 96 and right up until 2007.
Oh, wow.
8 or 9, something at 7, 8 in there. Because after the major projects in Kazakhstan, I was in Kazakhstan with for an election, set up a whole thing in Russian CDs. There was information out of Sweden. How to run a country, how to write a constitution, how to write laws, how to run an election, all on one CD in Russian, translated. We translated because that's the second line. And then went to do it in Uzbekistan. I got one seminar done, because I'd done dozens of seminars in Kazakhstan. How to run a polling station, how to mark, you know, how to promote a candidate and all that stuff. Went to Uzbekistan, I got one done, and the government closed it down. And I just got finished and said, well, you know, we'll be seeing the next group next week, and da da da. And they called me over and said, Judith, we want you to get in the car, and we're going to pick up stuff at your hotel. We're going to the airport, and we'll be there. You know, would you like to see? We were in Samarkand. We were in Tashkent. Would you like to see Samarkand and things? And I went, well, yeah, but no. And here's your money. They handed me a grocery bag of money that was worth about $50 to cover me for the week. And because they couldn't get me out of the country fast enough. So I had a driver and an interpreter in the car from Samarkand all the way to Bukhara and the desert and the Caspian Sea and whatnot. And then I came back, and then they flew me out, and I was gone. And that was the end of democracy work in Uzbekistan. And that man is still in office. Still in office. So fun times, fun times. So I came back from the Peace Corps. I did all that stuff. I got back from the Peace Corps and said to Bruce, I'm going to Peru tomorrow. He said, oh, really? Okay, good. It was just, I wanted to see Peru, and I hadn't been there.
So we were talking earlier, but how many countries do you think it's
been? Something over 50. 50, 1, 2, 3, 4, somewhere in there. Oh. Well, it was, there are 180 or something. I mean, it's not like it's a big, big number. But it's only places I've worked in or stayed in for a month or so. You know, or visited for that much. I went to Egypt a couple weeks after 9/11 because I'd booked it and I had it all lined up. And I thought it was possibly either the stupidest thing I ever did and it would be dangerous or it would be fine. And what I was stunned about was people were gracious. They were apologetic. You can spot a big American. I mean, you know, and they walk up to me in the street and say, we're terribly sorry. It wasn't us. It was just amazing, just amazing. So I had a magnificent time in Egypt about 10 days, a week, 2 weeks after the, kind of up the Nile and down the Nile and all the, you know, all that stuff. So then I was in Kosovo for 4 years. OSCE, elections and all that. And from there, and I was chief of training. I didn't know what a chief was, but apparently it's a big deal in a paramilitary operation. And in 2004, I went to Haiti for the UN and set up their first integrated mission training center. That's this, IMTC, which combined all of the I think they had 9,000 military and about 4,000 police and about 7,000 civilians. And so all of that was then going to be integrated, so they had to have a whole plan and a training center. These were farewell emails and things when I left. I went to Morocco with the UN, sunrise on a camel over the sand dunes. That's a Berber tent. This is an award I got for Meeting Planner of the Year at some point. This is a treasure. This is my certificate. We swear the same oath to be in the Peace Corps that the President does. We promise to support the Constitution. I'm not sure how you do that in Central Europe, but here is my Judith Davis in recognition, dedicated service, contribution, sustainable development, global understanding, world peace, serving as a Peace Corps in Slovakia, William Clinton. So this, I was thrilled. I haven't framed it yet. I keep meaning to frame it. I haven't framed it. This is my Peace Corps passport. You get a green passport because you are protected by the State Department, and I couldn't pay for it. I was so broke when I left, and they told us it was free. I went to the post office to get it, and they said, that'll be $20. And I said, no, I'm going to the Peace Corps, see, and they're supposed to be free, and it's free to me. And they said, no, it's $20. And I literally was leaving in like 2 days. I didn't have it. Mr. Vermilion, who should stay in the annals forever in Dallas, Texas post office, stepped in front of me and said, here, good luck. And he paid for it. So, Mr. Vermilion, you saved my Peace Corps career before it ever started. And I didn't have enough money for the coin thing out to get out of the parking lot. That's how broke I was before. $200 a month I was going to make. I think it was called our contingency or something. This was our 20th reunion. Most of us were there. We met up at one of my good buddy's house in Atlanta.
Hello.
It was a grand bunch.
How many were there?
30.
30?
Yeah, we were 30. So a couple had passed away by then, and whatever. This was the trip. Bruce met me in Maine when I took innkeepers. That was my brother-in-law then. What else? Peace Corps Slovakia. I wrote their annual reports for 3 years. We were the only one to produce an annual report. Peter was brilliant. He knew just what he wanted. He knew what to do.
So what kind of work did you do with the UN?
It was the IMTC, and it was integrating all three of the training programs. I mean, for instance, there were 5 levels of engagement. If anybody pulled a weapon, they had to meet Haitian law, UN requirements, their own country's rules of engagement or whatever, the ones for this particular mission, and their own commanding officer or something. I mean, there were literally 5 things they had to think of before they could pull a weapon in a mission. And that had to be trained in something like 24 languages. It was a big deal. And then there was management training and language training and accounting training and just all sorts of stuff that had to be done.
Mm-hmm.
So that was until 2008, and the UN insists that you leave at 62, which annoyed me no end. I kept going around. Forced retirement, that's what I'm doing. It's forced retirement, it's ridiculous. Because they really liked what I'd done and stuff, but I was gone. So I went to Cyprus, at the island of Cyprus, which is in the eastern end of the Mediterranean. It's the pointy one that points at Syria, and just loved it. Came over the mountains, very much like Santa Barbara, where I lived after the Peace Corps, very much like somewhere else I lived. You come over the mountains and there's the ocean. Just a beautiful place to live. It was the north side, it was the Turkish side. It's not recognized by anybody. Long involved political story, which we won't go into, but I really enjoyed living there. And I was there for almost 10 years. I worked at volunteered, I worked at a bookstore, I did a lot of coaching people who were trying to get their master's degrees from British universities and had to get their thesis in, that kind of thing. So one-on-one. I didn't teach at the university or anything. I thought, no, that's too much legwork. And I love being retired. I love, people say, oh, it's terrible, I don't know what to do. Oh, I love being retired. Books and tea, what else do you need? And then Bruce had his brain surgery and thought might be okay. I came back for a month, you know, help out a little bit. And I hadn't been back 10 days and he collapsed. And we don't know why. And I had to call the EMT and they took him off to the hospital and it was 4th of July weekend and we couldn't get a hold of anybody. It was awful. And he wasn't gonna quick recover. So I went back to Cyprus, I closed everything down and came here. And that started 2 years or 3 years of total culture shock. It was awful coming back here. It was terrible. I didn't know what was going on. I didn't understand anything. I didn't know what anything cost. I didn't know how to get a driver's license. I didn't know how to do anything. Somebody handed me a pen. I said, oh, I need a pen. They handed it to me. I said, what's the rubber end for? And they said, that's for your iPhone or your iPad. Oh, really? Oh, okay. I mean, it was that level of non-information. I mean, that level of incompetence. It was terrible. Very disorienting, rackety life while he's trying to recover and stuff. And now I need to work. So I have another care. I worked at Gaylord 5 hours a day, exhausting. Just as a breather of ice, you know. It was fun. It was interesting, nice people. Really tiring. And now I'm a caretaker for Bruce and a caretaker for another woman here. The grand sum of $9 an hour from the state of Texas to help her. But it helps. It helps if I'm on Social Security. The other piece of it was I no sooner retired 2007 and 2008, all the money I had saved for years and years and years was wiped out. Very conservative investments in England, whoosh, gone in the space of about 9 or 10 months, 12 months. So I thought I'd pretty well set myself up for, you know, getting to be at least 95 and I'd be okay because I was living happily on my Social Security overseas. I was saving money on the Social Security overseas. Cleaned out, absolutely cleaned out. So it's a whole different game. I've got to work. And it's hard work doing it at 74. What have I learned? Real quick, how much time am I going to... I've learned that people are very different, all the same around the world. I wouldn't trade my travel for anything, hardly that I can think of. I wouldn't trade the Peace Corps for anything. I've learned that everybody carries their own God inside. And it's a much nicer God than I grew up with, friendlier, less punitive, and so forth. I think that traveling abroad was priceless. I found that there are smart, competent, kind, and unkind people all over the world, mostly kind, mostly competent, mostly willing to share and learn, you know, and so forth. And there's so much to learn elsewhere, just to see it and learn about it and figure it out. Terrific people, competent people, knowledgeable people, smart people. I truly don't care about what they're now calling the Browning of America. So what? So what? It's wonderful. Because all of that experience, knowledge, energy, all the rest of it, that's what this country's built on. Immigrants. Why would we stop that? I mean, that's what's fed this country. Fed it with energy and ideas and changes and interesting things and all that. And then I made a list. One of the things about I'm constantly learning stuff. Now, not languages, you understand, but lots of other stuff. And growing. And deeper understanding about stuff. Like the sunrise on the desert is just remarkable. Just remarkable. Do you know how to open a banana in Russia? No. you know, bananas, and we always go woggle woggle with the stem end.
Mm-hmm.
And I did it in front of four or five Russians. They said, "What are you doing?" I said, "Well, I was going to eat this banana." "No, no." And they turn it to the other end. They nick the top, which is really what we think is the bottom. They nick it and peels perfectly every single time.
Mm-hmm.
How would I have learned that? How to peel a banana in Russia and here. The HIV seminars were wonderful. The sun setting on the Taj Mahal. I never dreamed I'd see the Taj Mahal. I stood in the middle of the Kremlin in Moscow as an American citizen. I was floored. And of course, the museums are exquisite. I mean, just magnificent art museums and that kind of thing. And right over the mountains from where I was in Poprad was Krakow. And I kept taking people who came to visit. I probably made four or five visits to Auschwitz and Birkenau. Horrific. You just can't imagine what went on there. I mean, and the boxes, the suitcases stacked up, and the hair and the teeth and the on and on and on. And just the horrendousness of it, that over a million people died just there in 7 years. That kind of thing. So you can't come back from that and say, "Boy, I think it's terrible that whatever, whatever, whatever." If we can do that to our own, we have got to pay attention and not do it to our own. We've just got to. I worked for a brilliant woman in Cambodia, and she had survived the Pol Pot camps. And stunning. She got herself to the United States, and her husband and her son to the United States. She got her master's degree in the U.S. and went back to help. Amazing. Just amazing.
What are some things that you've seen from your experience traveling overseas and everything that you wish would be applied here, especially in, like, the American political system and when it comes to voting rights?
Every other, what we consider civilized country in the world, has good health as a right and not as something you pay in a great amount of money for. And if you don't have a great amount of money, you're not healthy. Some kind of medicine for all that I saw at work in the former Soviet countries. Now, it wasn't the newest, snazziest, whatever. It was wonderful. I broke my ankle in Cyprus. I had three doctor visits at the house. I went on three trips to the hospital. I had two casts, all of that $400.
Wow.
That's much kinder to people living on, you know, of anybody. And that was not because I was a funny foreigner. That's what it cost. I mean, there is a funny foreigner tax in various places. We have to know that the right to vote is absolutely key to the health and vitality and perpetuation of any democracy. Some of the ones I worked in are still dictatorships. They are still oppressing their people. New dictatorships are showing up all the time because it's easier. So one strong guy, and okay, we'll just pay attention to that. I won't bother voting. And I'm pretty sure that's how it shows up. Most of the countries I worked in had an 80 or 90% turnout, and nobody was fined or anything. They just wanted to vote. In Bosnia, a 93-year-old came in, woman. She's all tattooed, which was considered beautiful, but very, you know, very, very important before you got married and whatnot. 93 years old. She had great-great-grandchildren, and she came in with two sticks, and she said, "I have never in my life voted in a free election, and by God, I'm gonna do it now." And we were all in tears. Everybody's in tears. The Bosnians in tears. She's in tears. The funny foreigners in tears. We're in tears. 93 years old, I've never voted in a free election. And here we don't seem to care. That bothers me a lot. Women have made tremendous progress, and I'm hoping I'm the last generation that thinks you have to change your name, kowtow to your husband. I couldn't get a credit card by myself. I couldn't sign for my house by myself. I really had to fight that one to buy my first house. I couldn't buy a business suit when I got out of college. You could buy a little fluffy blouse and you could buy a skirt, but you could not buy a blazer and a jacket, you know, a skirt or trousers or something. That kind of stuff is gone. And the right to choose what you want. I wouldn't wish an abortion on my worst enemy. I would not. It's an awful, awful thing. And I don't